All right, so as we move into 22 through 24, we're going to discuss a couple of psalms that David wrote. But to get an idea, you know, this psalm here in 2 Samuel 22 is also recorded in Psalms 18. But it says in verse 1, it says, "And David spoke the words of this song to the Lord in the day that the Lord delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul." So we've been discussing David for a period of time now. I mean, we've been discussing him for the last, I don't know, 10, 12 classes, it seems like. Now, we're on class 17, so probably 10, 11 classes. He entered the scene during Saul's reign. That's not a lot of time in the grand scheme of a man's life, especially all that David accomplished, to know a lot about him. But we do want to point out, you know, that as we've studied this, the Bible records what it does to help us progress the storyline. You know, we're progressing through the United Kingdom, but there's a greater arc through the entire Old Testament to get to the New, and that is the purpose of man and God's covenant and salvation through what will eventually be Jesus Christ. So you can see that kind of start from Genesis 2 on. There's sin enters the world. There's, you know, resolution through Christ Jesus and his atoning blood later on, but there's a story arc to go through. The covenants that are made, the life lessons that we can learn, what would God have us to do? Specifically with David, you know, we've been told certain things about him, but we don't know everything. And sometimes we gloss over some of the things in David's life, you know, as we just progress through a storyline. David is great in the sense that we have a lot of psalms to discuss his feelings, his emotions, how he viewed things. He is a prophet. God is with him. And he gives us an insight into himself as he's dealing with a lot of different circumstances and situations. So to set the scene for this, where David's going to kind of open up and discuss this deliverance of the Lord, you know, from his hands of the enemies and of Saul. I'm just going to mention a couple of verses and we'll look at a couple as well. Remember what David's been through. David first came on the scene when he slew Goliath. He slew Goliath and he was a young man. We're not exactly sure how old. He could have been, you know, 12, 13. He could have been closer to 20. But the fact that he was the one who would go up against their champion when the rest of Israel wouldn't, when the king wouldn't, you think about his character. But then you think about his reliance on God. But then he still has to have courage as he enters into different situations and scenarios. So I think about in 1 Samuel 19, where he's married to Micah and Saul's wanting to kill him and to get away from him. She's got to let him down through the window in a basket so he can escape. And then you think about moving into 1 Samuel 21, where he enters into Gath and then he has to feign his sanity. I mean, he acts crazy. He feigns insanity because he's worried about what might happen to him. You know, these things where he's constantly in the clutches of his enemies or being chased or pursued. You think about in 1 Samuel 23, where he is besieged by Saul, he's getting ready to be besieged. He's at Keilah, he's just saved those people, and then Saul hears that he's there. He prays to God. David prays to God to find out if he's going to be besieged. He decides to leave because God tells him that they would give him up otherwise. You think about that. Saul's constantly pursuing him. Look over at 2 Samuel 23. No, I mean, sorry, 2 Samuel. 1 Samuel 23. We'll look at this and one other. To get this idea of the constant pursuance of David and constantly being chased and enemy is at his doorstep, you think about verse 25 of 1 Samuel 23. "When Saul and his men went to seek him, they told David, and he came down to the rock and stayed in the wilderness of Moen. And when Saul heard it, he pursued David in the wilderness of Moen. Saul went out on one side of the mountain, and David and his men on the other side of the mountain. And David was hurrying to get away from Saul, for Saul and his men were surrounding David and his men to seize him." You think about how close they could have been on the mountain. Mountains are vast, but you can see a long way. We came back in Colorado, and sometimes you don't get the scope of how large something is. But on the other hand, you can see over there. And to think that he is that close. He may not be able to get me right there, but to see that your enemy is on your doorstep, that he is going to pursue me, and I'm heading around one way as he's heading around another, and not knowing exactly where he is, but he's within a close proximity to you. And what are you going to do? How do you get away? It says here that that he was getting ready to encircle him. And so look over at 1 Samuel 20. To me, this gives you an idea into David's mindset. Now, this is earlier on than some of the stuff that I've discussed. But again, getting this idea of what David is feeling. In 1 Samuel 20, I'm going to read 1 through 3. Then David fled from Noath in Ramah and came and said to Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my iniquity? What is my sin before your father in that he is seeking my life?" Now, this is when Micah has let him down and he's fled. Verse 2, he said to him, "Far from it. You shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. So why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so." So he's confiding in Jonathan, and Jonathan's trying to encourage him. But verse 3, it says, "Yet David vowed again, saying, 'Your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight, and he has said, do not let Jonathan know this, or he will be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and the death." Me and death. That's how David feels. And we continue to see that. He's a step away from death as Saul continues to pursue him. This doesn't include all the battles that we really don't know a ton about. We'll read a little bit later about his mighty men and some of the crazy things that they've done. But you think about that. How many times has David been facing death? And then as we look at 2 Samuel 22, we're going to see how he views God as he's escaped this time and time again. Not escaped. God has delivered him. And that's kind of the setting for this as we read. So let's go back over to 2 Samuel 22. Now, I'm not going to read this psalm. I trust that y'all have read it before, but I want to look at a couple of different sections. So I asked the question, how does David describe the Lord in verses 2 through 6 of this psalm? Okay, is rock, deliverer, fortress, strength? What is he, and I put for this section, 2 through 6, what is he trying to convey? What is the Lord to him? God is his protector. That's the way David sees him. I completely agree with Matt. Now, this is the setting of the psalm, is that, you know, God's going to deliver him, and God is his protector. That is what he is describing. Moving into 7 through 16, what image is David picturing in 7 through 16? And list some phrases that helped this image be more vivid to you. He's crying out to the Lord. I heard something. Betty, was that you? Oh, Carol. Swift judgment. All right, what else do you see in the 7 through 16?
It's not uncommon for these Old Testament writers to use cosmic or celestial pictures of God's judgment. That's what we have in Matthew 24, at the destruction of Jerusalem, for example. Destruction of Babylon. And evidently here, those pictures are used.
And I would call it, and correct me if this would create the wrong connotation, but it's artistic license, or he's painting the picture. He's setting this scene for you, and you think about that. You know, when this picture is of God coming down to deliver him, the 7 through 16. "In my distress, I called upon the Lord." And then verse 8, "Then the earth shook and quaked, and the foundations of heaven were trembling and were shaking because he was angry." This is God painting. This is David painting the picture of how he views God's my protector. When I called upon him, here he comes. He comes down to deliver me. And a formidable foe, I would say God is. I would think you would too. You know, you think about this. The way he paints a picture. Imagine you were the enemy seeing this, you know, coming at you. So the earth shook and quaked. Foundations of the heaven were trembling. Smoke went out of his nostrils. Fire from his mouth devoured. You know, maybe the idea of, you can picture in your mind what you wish, but, you know, maybe like a dragon, or you see these movies and you see these, can you get these vivid images of something very formidable or fierce or mighty coming at you. It says, he bowed the heavens, verse 10, and he came down with thick darkness under his feet. He rode a cherub and flew. Now, a cherub, what do you take or what do you envision when you think of a cherub?
Sweet baby
angel. A fat little baby angel, right? And so that's what you think about. So, in the tangents or, going down the rabbit hole, so to say, you start looking up cherubs and everything. That is a picture, but you can look at a lot of different places, including in Ezekiel. And cherubs were winged. They had faces of men, faces of lions. There in Ezekiel 10, it talks about they had the face of four faces, a cherub, a man, and a lion and an eagle, four wings, human hands, a celestial being. So it's not a little fat baby angel. This is a winged creature of heaven that God is riding down. It's a matter like a fierce or more imposing. And it's a vivid imagery is what we're talking about here. So to them, it would mean different to us. And we'll get more into the cherub talk because it was on the Ark of the Covenant. It's going to be a part of the temple. But, you think about the picture he's painting, that this God is coming down, how he's coming and, earth moving. That's kind of some of this, moving the elements and he's creating this formidable foe or picture of nothing's going to stop him. He's going to get there and intimidate an opponent. It says he made, verse 12, he made the darkness canopies around him, a mass of water, thick clouds of sky. From the brightness before him, coals of fire were kindled. The Lord thundered from heaven, and the Most High uttered his voice, and he sent out arrows and scattered them, lightning and routed them. Then the channels of the sea appeared, and the foundations of the world were laid bare, but by the rebuke of the Lord, at the blast of the breath of his nostrils. The Lord was coming down. And if that million mean, nothing's going to stop him. I'm scared. I'm worried. I'm running. If I see this picture, this is how David views him. Only David views him as his salvation, his savior, coming to clutch him up, deliver him from this enemy. So what does verse 17 through 20 describe? The Lord delivering David from his enemies. So this is what this psalm is about. And so here comes God, and he's painted this picture of a mighty foe, but also a grand deliverer to come and save him. And that's what he talks about in verse 17. He sent from on high and took me. He drew me out of many waters. He delivered me from my strong enemy, from those who hated me, and for they were too strong for me. This is written, of these instances he's went through. You think about the depths of despair that David may have been in. He has courage. He believes in God. He's willing to fight the tough fights. But how despondent could he have been during these times? It's tough to have courage even though you've got faith. And as he's writing this afterward, maybe he sees a light at the end of the tunnel. He sees God as in the depths of the despair, God, the one true and living God, coming to save him, to rescue him, to deliver him again. What joy, what emotion that would make you feel when you're in the depths of the despair, maybe not knowing what's going to happen, but knowing God is going to come and rescue you and snatch you up, deliver you from this thing, from certain death. He's writing this afterward, and this is the imagery he uses. How would you describe verses 34 through 49? Well, and I put what title would you give it? Kind of the idea. They're two in one question.
Salvation is in the Lord.
Mm-hmm. Okay. David's praised God for the deliverance of his enemies. What else? How else would you categorize this? There's not really a wrong answer here. I mean, my answer is not going to be your answer. Like I said, I mean, this is just how we're interpreting or how we're looking at what David's writing as he envisions and discusses God delivering him.
Strength and guidance come from God.
I labeled this as what he did for David. This is what God did for David. We skipped a section. We may come back to it later on in a different context, but we skipped 21 through 24, which I've labeled why God saved David, and then 25 through 33 was talking about who is God. We get down to 34 through 49, and this what God has, what he did for David. He says he makes my feet like hinds' feet. He sets me on high places. He continues on through here. He attributes all this to God, all his victories, all his abilities, everything. He attributes this to God. God, look at what God has done for me. And in so, he has delivered me from my enemies. He's allowed me to survive. He goes on all the way through 49. Who else brings me out from my enemies? You even lift me above those who rise up against me. You rescue me from the violent man. He says in verse 50, therefore I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among these nations. And I will sing praises to your name. He is a tower of deliverance to his king and shows the loving kindness to his anointed, to David and his descendants forever. You know, this is the picture he's painted, you know. And so it's interesting as we've looked at the larger picture of David and his life and different things he's gone through. We kind of gloss over. We've discussed for 10 or 15 minutes at most, you know, different battles or circumstances he's been through. But here, this is David pouring out his heart as to how he views God as his deliverer, as his savior, and what God has done for him. Now, how do we make that applicable to us? Can we make it applicable? We should really reflect on what God has done for us. Maybe sitting down, you know, after a grand event, whether it be good or bad, and look at how God has interacted in our lives and the faith that we have in him. And did we put our faith and trust in him? To look back and see how things have evolved in your life and to be thankful for God and what he's done. You know, that's what David is doing. He's reflecting on these things and how he views God in those certain situations. And we should reflect as well. Now, it doesn't mean we're going to have the same type of poetry or language or ability to write this stuff down, but to go to God in prayer and to thank him for how he's intervened in our lives or how he's been in our lives or how he's guided us would be good. To pour our hearts out like David did. That's the interesting thing about David is David's poured his heart out, but we have this record to read of how he felt and how he viewed those certain situations and circumstances. Questions or comments?
It's interesting, I think. We associate songwriters with the guy who's in the house, a poet of some sort. Here's a man who was a man of war, a general in battle. Here's a man who was wealthy. Here's a man who was powerful. He was the most powerful man in the nation. And yet he's a man that is not ashamed to sing God's praise.
He was a manly man. I mean, that's kind of David's a manly man, but he's got this other side to him. You know, I don't know. Seems like when you see stuff on TV of the more artistic type songwriter or whatever, they're pasty white, wearing some beanie or beret in some hipster shop or something. That, you know, David had a myriad of talents. His greatest character was that he was a man after God's own heart. But he was a mighty man. He fought battles. He was an expert in warfare, but he also poured his heart out in this and used his abilities, these songs that he writes. I mean, to not be afraid to show that side of himself, because what encouragement and what insight do we get from it now? And so, it's a great thing. We can wear more than one hat, and he wasn't afraid to be willing to bear his soul to God. And we may not like doing that in front of other people. I'm not saying you need to, but to be able to open yourself up wholly and completely to God and to thank him for what he's done, or to express your concern, your tribulation, your love, joy, to him, that's what we should strive to do, to be able to open ourselves up to him in that way. Any other comments before we move on? All right, so this other song, 2 Samuel 23. So there's a subtitle here. It says David's last song. And verse 1 kind of gives us the understanding, right? Why? Now, these are the last words of David. David, the son of Jesse, declares. And so then we see what is the song that he wrote. So I asked, how would you describe this song? What tone does it have?
Jubilant.
Song of gratitude.
Righteous rule, righteous judgment. And in my mind, I tend to lean towards it being this end.
Okay. What else?
Faith and thankfulness.
There seems to be a glimpse of what you've been putting out in this song. That there's this overriding recognition that he's a part of a lot bigger picture. That he talks about the covenant God made with him.
Mm-hmm. I agree to all those. I mean, what gets to me about this song is, to me, it seems it's his last song, and that may color my view of this, but it's a song of reflection. You read 2 Samuel 22, and there seems a little bit more like vim and vigor in what he's talking about. Verses 23, where there seems to be reflection on his life and what God has done for him. He's still gracious and thankful for all that God has done for him. But I mean, to me, it definitely lends itself more to finality or wisdom and his mindset. You know, the Spirit of the Lord spoke by me, and his words were on my tongue. The God of Israel said, the Rock of Israel spoke to me, and he rules over men righteously, who rules the fear of God. Is as the light of the morning when the sun rises, a morning without clouds, when the tender grass springs out of the earth through the sunshine after rain. Truly is not my house so with God, for he has made an everlasting covenant with me in order that all things and secured for all my salvation, all my desire, he will not indeed make it grow. By the worthless, every one of them will be thrust away like thorns, because they cannot be taken in hand. But the man who touches them must be armed with iron and the shaft of spear, and they will be completely burned with fire in their place. He kind of spices it up there at the end. But the idea, he's looking back, or he's as a reflection of his life and what God has done for him. Gratitude and thankfulness, putting God first, exalting him. That's just kind of how I would think about him. I mean, he's older. We know he's getting ready to meet his maker here in these next couple of chapters. And, you know, how your outlook on life changes as you get older, and the experiences that you've been through, the wisdom that you gain, and the reflection. To me, there's reflection here. Now, tell me, you know, yes, no, do you see it or not? I mean, maybe I'm deluded in that sense, but
that's what you have.
Kind of a song of reflection. All right, so any other comments on that? So now we enter into this next section. We get a little bit more information, and then a couple classes down the line, I've been touching on a subject that we'll kind of come back to later on. You know, the things that you learn and the things that we're going to discuss, you know, towards the end of class that maybe we should talk about at the beginning, just, you know, the things that pique your interest as you learn. One of these things is David's mighty men, you know, about, you know, David's winning these victories, God's allowing it to happen, but who are these men that are who are with him? And so here we have a glimpse of some of these men and what we find out about them. So I asked, who are the most notable and why? And it seems like there's three that are, you know, singled out. You can butcher the names, I do. Ma'am? Oh, you chose the hard name. I chose Zendino. And what is notable about him? He killed 800 men. I mean, at one time. Think about that. I mean, you think about, go back to Absalom and the counsel he received from Ahithophel and from Hushai. You know, the fact that they needed 12,000 men to go conquer David, and there's, what, 33 listed here, something like that, or 37? I mean, why do we need 12,000 men to go catch this guy? Well, and there's more than just that, which will be the... we'll talk about it in a minute. But, you know, why? Well, because you got somebody here who can slay 800 men at one time. Or that was one of his accomplishments. The mighty men that he dealt with, how great of a warrior he was and under David's command. Who else was mentioned? Eleazar? What might be something that you could say about him? Yeah, verse 10, he arose and struck the Philistines until his hands were very weary and clung to the sword. He was one of three that were willing to stand with David in battle. Now, the Philistines, they're who? And, you know, they're not just some ordinary foe. They're these great men, a warring nation. And when everybody else flees, you got, here's one of two other men outside of David who's willing to stand and to fight and to prevail. What a mighty man he must have been. The courage that it took to do such a thing. How great he is as far as warrior goes. How about, who's the third that's mentioned? Shema. What's it said about him?
He did,
and that's the three, Adino, Eleazar, and Shammah did that. It also says in verse 11 that he fought a troop of Philistines, and the Philistines were gathered in a troop where there was a plot of ground full of lentils, and the people fled from the Philistines. But he took his stand in the midst of the plot, defended it, and struck the Philistines, and the Lord brought out a great victory. He himself stood against a troop of Philistines. I mean, think about that. These are the foes. I mean, these are the opponents that you've got to face if you're coming against Israel and you're coming against David. These are the men you're fighting. That's why 12,000 men may not have been enough. That's why, you know, they are a formidable foe as you continue through and you read about these men. And then, so I put on here, what are some of the notable things about the mighty men? And that was one of them, that these three men broke through the lines just because David said he wished to have some water from the well at Bethlehem, and they were willing to do so. And then when David got it, they endangered these men's lives, so he offers the water to God because he shouldn't have endangered their lives. But how crazy, fierce, you know, loyal these men were. And so we kind of get a tidbit of that. What's something else that you notice about these men? Give me some descriptors for them. I've been using several of them already. They're loyal to David, for sure.
Fearless.
Skilled, for sure. What's it? Sir?
They fought.
They were definitely courageous. Stood there and fought. What's interesting about them?
On the last two men, the Lord evidently had a pretty big hand in delivering the victory.
It does. That God would be with them. Whether they were believers in God or God was with them because of David, we don't know. And that's an aside for another. We've talked about it before. Whether they were their godly. We talked about Uriah, whether he was a godly man or who's just loyal to David. But God, God is, you can see his providence or his hand in those battles. What about the composition of these men? What do I mean by that? Okay, so I tried to go through, and man, I tell you what, there's too many like nations and then subsects and then tribes and everything, but it does not appear that all these men were of the tribes of Israel and Judah. Some of these men were foreigners. So now you've got these mighty men who are foreigners, or at least from some of the study that I've done, could have been foreigners, come from other lands, who are willing and to fight for David. Whether they were godly men or whether they were just loyal to David, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. You know, we'll talk about it now. So why would, you know, these men fight for David? You know, these mighty men. I mean, what character must David have had, or what are some qualities that David had that may have lent to these men coming to want to fight for him?
He's not probably loyal to them.
Loyal to them.
Mm-hmm. Then boss now. You're going to go all in to follow, defend, fight for whatever. So with these men doing that, that shows David's strength as a leader and character as a leader. And
oh, I completely agree. Is this a foreign concept to us in today's time or in our lives as we know them? That may be a could have been better worded, but is this a foreign concept to us? I think of King Arthur, you know, somebody who's upright and just and righteous and loyal to his men, and he's trying to do what's right, and so just his men aren't always the greatest men or believe in the same things he does, but they're loyal to him because he is sincere and honorable and courageous and respectful and, you know, those sort of things. And so we don't know if these men were godly or not, but they obviously were loyal to David for a reason. And David constantly prevailed because God allowed it, because of his faith in God. And these men were loyal to him. Why? Because he was a good leader or because he was a great warrior. I don't know, but it's just interesting that these men fall in line in that way. And I don't think that's a foreign concept that we can read in literary works or we can see in our lives today as you look at leaders who are good. Mm-hmm.
You know, God uses men for his purpose. And you see, you know, to me, when David asked these three men to go and give him a drink of water, because he wanted it from a certain place, and it was going to cause life. It was dangerous to go in there. And he bring it back, and then David don't even drink it.
Mm-hmm.
On the ground, and he said it was because of the blood. But they still followed him. And so, you know, sometimes things happen that is not because of the king or whatever, it's because of God's purpose.
I agree. So as you go back, if you go back and study these lessons again, or as you study David again, maybe it'll give you a better appreciation. It has for me, you know, when you read about these mighty men being with David, and to know a little bit more about them and why they're added at the end of his life versus the beginning, I don't know. But, you know, you think about when he leaves and he's fighting Absalom and these men, and that he's only got his mighty men, and he's got the Cherethites and the Perethites, and we'll talk about them in a little while, but, you know, they, how much more they add to the story, or how you view David and his presence in these battles. You know, maybe it'll give you a little bit more insight there. All right, moving on. Sorry, go ahead, Todd. I saw Abishai, his brother. I don't know that I saw Joab in there.
It just gives you a sense that these mighty men are a special unit, not leaders of generals that organize the general army, as Joab is. It's a different skill set. These guys are the elite fighting guys, whereas the leadership, general types, organizing people over thousands and hundreds.
Well, you did have some who were over thousands and hundreds. Abishai was one who was put over some, but you're looking more like a skilled force, and that somebody, they're the tip of the spear. You know, they're you point in that direction and they go and they conquer. They do. Now, you do have a couple who are like that, and Benadab. Benaniah. We'll see him later on be named as the commander of the armies, but. But the idea here is that these were his elite fighting force, these mighty men. And so they had a specific skill, and they know how to use that specific... What's that part from Taken, from Liam Neeson? Like, I got this one set of skills, and that's the way I'm going to use them. That's what that is. All right, moving on. We're running out of time. My fault. 2 Samuel 24, 1 through 9. What's going on here? David wanted to have a census. Did Joab agree with David's decision to take the census?
No.
So what does he say? Now, why do you want to call guilt on Israel? And how long did this census take? 9 months and 20 days. Now, who was counted? All but Levi and Benjamin. So we find that out, and this is where having Chronicles helps out in your study, because you've got mirrored stories here. So you can go to 1 Chronicles 21 and see that Levi and Benjamin weren't counted. Here's something else that's interesting, and I can't necessarily explain the discrepancy, but how many were there, and is this a complete number?
500,000.
Okay, and who got a different answer than that? And Susan's correct. I mean, they're listed in both places. I don't know. That's for another time and place. But we have two numbers here. I don't know if one number was without some, or and then some were assumed. Just interesting, not consequential to our story, because we're really talking about why David did what he did. So was God pleased with the census? No, it says in 1 Chronicles 21:7 he was not. Did David understand what he had done wrong? Yes, David did understand. We see that in 2 Samuel 24:10. He says, David's heart's troubled him after he had numbered the people. And so he says, I have sinned greatly in what I've done. Why maybe did David take the census or order the census or whatnot? What do you know about that? Actually, don't ask that question because y'all don't have it in your notes. I have it in mine. And that'll speed up things. If you look back in Exodus 30, part of the census is that it's a memorial. In Exodus 30:11-16, it says that it may be a memorial for the sons of Israel before the Lord to make atonement for yourselves. In verse 12, it says of each one of the people shall give a ransom for himself to the Lord. Numbers 31:50 says to make atonement for ourselves. So part of the census was you were to provide payment for the temple. And it's to show atonement for your sins. Now, David wasn't happy. It says in verse 1, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel and it incited David against them. Why his anger burned against Israel and why it incited David? But maybe David's like, I'm going to take a census and make them pay for their atonement. Maybe he's trying to force the situation and force them to atone for their sins. It's just an interesting aside that that's what a census does, is you're supposed to pay a ransom and to atone. Anyway, we see that David shouldn't have done it. We see that he sins in doing so, and so we see that he's punished. And so what were David's options for punishment? Seven years of famine is one of them. 3 months fleeing or 3 days of pestilence. What's another word for pestilence? Plague. So you've got those three options. What did he choose and why? He chose pestilence, the plague. Why did he choose it? Didn't want to fall into the hand of man. I don't know how the famine would have played into that, but from the standpoint of fleeing, he'd been on the run. He wanted judgment from God. He didn't want to fall into the hand of man. He wanted to fall into the hand of God. And so he chose pestilence.
Well, the famine, he would have to ask the nation
for food and help. And if he's conquered them and battled them, they're not going to help him. That's true. He's dependent upon other nations. Yes. And so that would be more the hands of man as well. So that's a good explanation for that. We see he didn't want to do those things. He'd rather God deal with them. So how many people died because of what he did? 70,000 men died because of that. And who administered this punishment? The angel of the Lord. This is an interesting context, and we don't have a lot of time to discuss it. But the angel of the Lord, you see that the angel of the Lord comes down. Does anyone see him? See the angel of the Lord? David, not only David sees him, but Oren sees him. Let's see, verse 16, I'm in the wrong verse, 20. Now Oren turned back and saw the angel and his four sons who were with him, hid themselves. So Oren saw this angel of the Lord. This angel of the Lord had a sword. Once David built this altar, he sheathed the sword. But you think about this angel of the Lord going and destroying these people, to David to see it and then to see Oren to see it, you know, how eerie or unsettling or scared would you have been to see the angel of the Lord who's been putting to death so many men? What does David do in 1 Chronicles 21:17? My sin, judge me, punish me, not these people. You know, now David was incited against him. David was incited against him because the Lord's anger burned against him. But ultimately, he said, "I sinned. Be against me." He showed his compassion for the people, and the fact that he's owning up to his sin. What is David commanded to do in 18:25? Build an altar for the Lord, and so that's what he does. He goes to Ornan and he buys the property. He buys the oxen, he builds an altar and makes a sacrifice to the Lord to abate the Lord's anger. It's interesting in that context too that he wants to buy the stuff. And the idea that if you're gonna build an altar and you're going to sacrifice to God, you should put forth an effort or some type of monetary value or put forth something of yourself versus just somebody gives me everything so then I can offer it. Where's your stake in it? I guess would be a good way to put that. Now, we've got a couple of minutes left, and I kind of rushed through that last little section because I wanted to discuss something for a second. You know, we're coming to, I said this is kind of David's swan song. We're entering the last years of David's life. We're going to be discussing his death in the next class. And we've kind of gone from this view of David. We talked about his he's a man after God's own heart. And then we've hit some bumps on the road, and now we're kind of ending his life. But it's a, you know, I don't want to take away from the character of David. You know, and how he's viewed by those who come after him. You know, he is the measurement by which all other kings would be measured. Even Josiah, who was a godly king, he did everything as David had done it, essentially. I mean, he's the unit of measurement. Acts 13:22 said that David is a man after God's own heart, which is what God wanted. You know, what I'm talking about is sometimes we can look at people and want to tear them down for the few bumps in the road that they hit or the few missteps in their lives. But David is viewed as a very, very godly man. And he's put here on the pedestal from the standpoint of trying to achieve to that. This story is meant to give us an understanding of David, but it's to progress the storyline, to get to Solomon, to understand how the United Kingdom keeps going and how what happens to the nation of Israel. But let's not forget those things. You know, you think about David as far as character goes, you know, when you read this story, because we've only got, you know, we had 10 or 11 lessons. We had 20, 30 something chapters on David. How much more of his life do we not know about? But he had the loyalty of foreign men. He had, you think about his victory over the Amalekites and the fact that he was a fair man. He divided those spoils even amongst those who weren't able to go out because they were tired. You think about how godly he was, you know, in his speech from Goliath. I'd love to go back and read that, 46 and 47, where he basically puts Goliath in his place. You know, here's the Lord your God. You're going to bow before him. You know, who are you? He humbles himself when it comes to bringing the ark to the temple. He says he's lightly esteemed and he's going to be humble in his own eyes. How humble of a man was he? How humble he was to think, well, look at the house that I've got and I want to build a temple for the Lord. How can I not build a temple for the Lord when he's done what he's done for me? So as we enter the end of David's life, let's not remember the last few chapters we studied, but how great David is viewed, you know, and the love of God and the pedestal that he's put on, that God says he's a man after his own heart. You know, we've read a couple of bad things, but our sum total of our life isn't the few bad things we've done. It's the character that we've built. And there's so much more we don't know about David, but we know that he was a godly man and so many others aspired to his faith, to his courage, to his reign and his rule. So, all right, that'll be it for now. I'll have more material on Wednesday. I didn't get a chance to type them, but we'll be in 18 on Wednesday. Thank you.